I believe every architect in this country has to be a conservationist.
With beginnings in a garden shed, Brinda Somaya became the force behind more than 200 projects. Her unique blend of design, conservation, and social equity exemplifies why she's a guardian of both the built and unbuilt.
The most important way to conserve is not to demolish and not to build new, but to recycle, retrofit, restore, and reuse what exists.
What does that then say about the role of the designer, the architect?
That's the challenge of the architect.
What do you think is a model for urbanism in India today?
It's very complex and complicated in a country like India. The span is enormous. There isn't one India, so there cannot be one solution.
Does restoration ultimately cost more per square meter than building anew?
It really depends on...
We all have had common traditions, problems.
I was a woman starting 40 years ago in an India which was very isolated, deprived in many ways. Today, it's completely different. India's growing. It's becoming an important country in the global scenario. There's a lot of awareness. There is a lot of freedom. There's a good middle class. The rich, of course, are doing extraordinarily well. What about the poor? Architects have to be activists. They have to...
Welcome to Ecogradia, where we meet experts and practitioners at the front lines of sustainable architecture and urbanism. My name is Nirmal Krishnani. I'm a sustainable design strategist, author, and educator based in Singapore. Over time on this podcast, I've had several guests from India. My guest today, Brinda Somaya, is different. She has carved herself a unique space in the sustainability conversation in this vast country. Her design practice in Mumbai is best known for award-winning heritage conservation projects. But she's also celebrated for new buildings that speak to social equity and environmental impact. Her point of view, she says, has evolved with time. Across 40 years and over 200 projects, she has witnessed the march of history from the resource-constrained 70s to the liberated economy of the 90s to a connected and digitized India today. Brinda embraces the complexity that is India and points to an underlying order amidst what may seem to an outsider like me, apparent chaos. There is a lot to unpack. Let's find out from Brinda in a moment. A quick reminder before we start. You can get more out of this episode on our website at ecogradia.com, where you'll find curated images and notes that top up what's being discussed today. And if you like what you hear, please hit the follow button on your preferred podcast directory to never miss an episode. Also, since we're now a nominee on this year's Webby Awards, which celebrates excellence on the internet, you can vote for Ecogradia in the Sustainability and Environment Podcast category until Thursday, 18th April, 2024. Simply go to our website to find the link that leads you straight to the Webby's voting page. Thank you so very much. Your support means the world to us. Season 4 of Ecogradia is sponsored by the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation was created in 2003 to empower a community of future makers through the transfer of ideas, knowledge, and real-world solutions. Check out past winners of the Holcim Awards from all over the world, plus events and publications at holcimfoundation.org. That's H-O-L-C-I-M Foundation, one word, .org. And now, without further ado, here's Brinda Somaya. Brinda Somaya, welcome to Ecogradia.
Thank you so much, Nirmal. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Oh, thank you for making the time to be with me.
Always.
I ask this of architects sometimes. If you were starting out today as a fresh graduate, how would your trajectory be different in today's market conditions?
Oh, I can't even begin to tell you how different it would be. For me personally, you know, I was a woman starting 40 years ago in an India in the 1970s, which was very isolated, which was deprived in many ways. There were no computers, of course. There was no technology. So that was the India that I began work on. And we had the masters. The British had left, you know, 20 years before that. And we had the strong, we had Corbusier and Kahn. And then we had the strong masters like Courier and, you know, Kanwinde and all of them. And we were just like, you know, looking up at them. They were even dreaming that we would be able to set up a practice or build up a practice. Today, it's completely different. I mean, young people have so much confidence. India's growing, it's becoming, you know, an important country in the global scenario. They have access to everything. They have access to the world in terms of travel, in terms of technology. So the confidence level is completely different. You know, we were very different people from the young people today, and good for them. I'm happy for them.
And you are, of course, highly regarded as an expert in conservation and adaptive reuse. And you said the word conservation goes way beyond conserving our heritage or colonial buildings. It is actually a sustainable practice. Let's unpack the meaning of those words. What does sustainability then mean?
Well, sustainability, naturally, one of the meanings of sustainability would be to recycle, retrofit, restore, and reuse what exists. In a country like India, we have millions, and I mean thousands and thousands of ordinary buildings which need to be recycled. So the most important way to conserve is not to demolish and not to build new, but to restore and repair. So that goes without saying, because then we don't create debris, we don't bring in new material, we see how we can reuse what there is. Particularly in a country like India, apart from ordinary buildings, we have thousands and thousands of monuments listed by the Archaeological Survey of India, being a 2,000, 3,000 or even older civilization. So I believe every architect in this country has to be a conservationist as well. They don't necessarily all need to be specialists and have degrees, because everyone cannot go and get a degree in conservation. But I believe it's inherent in our nature, and we have to put some part of our practice towards conservation.
You were involved with the Indian Institute of Management Buildings. I mean, these were buildings designed by Louis Kahn in Ahmedabad. And there was an initial outcry, you know, when it was announced that they would be demolished. And then the decision was reversed and your firm was appointed to conserve and restore. I mean, you even won a UNESCO award, I think one of four that your office has won for these projects. Now the project is again slated for demolition. Now, I just want to talk through this idea of conservation. First of all, who decides on what to conserve and why?
They had a director at one time who was very open and who really wanted to take care and restore and repair the building. So they held an international competition, which my studio won. And the competition included the conservation of the three buildings around the Louis Kahn Plaza. That's the library building, the faculty block, and the classroom block, as well as 18 dormitories. So we took up the library building, which was a very important building and also not in a very good shape. We worked with structural engineers. We also had peer review from the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras, where we had very highly trained professionals to assist us, because, you know, there had been an earthquake and so there was some damage to the building. So it was fully restored, and the inside, you know, what is a library today? It's not the same use as when Kahn perhaps designed it, you know, whatever, 40, 50 years ago. So technology had to be brought in, the way the students use it, the way they sit next to each other, the way they look at the books and the digitization. So the interiors are very contemporary. So it was a wonderful restoration project. And we won, of course, the UNESCO Award of Distinction. You know, that's one of their highest awards. So we were really very happy and pleased that it had been so successful. Subsequently, they asked us to begin on the faculty building, which we then began on. And for reasons which would be only known to the board of the IIM, they decided to stop the project. Of course, it broke my heart, and we had to, we left the project without doing any further work on the faculty building. What they intend to do now, I have no idea about. See, finally, it comes down to what people want, doesn't it? If the people who surround the building or who own the building or who use the building, they are the ones who have to save the building. because otherwise nobody can. Mm. I mean, that's the case in the IIM. If the board or the people concerned want to save it, then it's up to them. Many of the school buildings, I've restored four colonial school buildings in the heart of the fourth area of Mumbai with a beautiful church, the St. Thomas Cathedral, which belonged to the school. Now, the board of the school, they understood the importance of these buildings. They wanted to modernize education, so we were able to add on new sections to the old heritage buildings. And then they needed money for the church. So to the side of the church, there were some small little attached buildings. We made that into the little kindergarten school. So the school uses money from the kindergarten fees to maintain the church. Now, this is the way that people have to work. They have to find money because everything costs money, even restoration work. But there has to be a will. They must want to do it. So it's up to the people around that building to understand why they want to save it and what use it will be. Every building is not the Parthenon or the Acropolis or the Taj Mahal, where you can do that, or Humayun's tomb. The rest of India is full of buildings that need to be used. Adaptive reuse or restoration or retrofitting, which is something we have also done.
You pointed out that there is a cost question driving these discussions. Does restoration ultimately cost more per square meter than building anew?
It depends on the condition of the building, and it depends on the materials that building has been built of, whether it's a stone building or it's a brick building. Now, the stone buildings in colonial Mumbai are in a better condition than the new buildings that were built in the 1970s, when, as you may know, that cement and steel were so adulterated and big issues. But with the IIM, the brick has caused its own issues. So it's very difficult to actually say whether it's more or less expensive.
The question then really is, what's the business case for keeping these buildings, right? Not the heritage stuff, which I think it's hard to argue against, for tearing down the IIM. It's such an important building. But what about the everyday stuff? Is that a harder sell?
You see, as long as the floor space index for a particular piece of land does not exceed the built-up area that building that's currently standing on it exists, then there is no desire for greed to break it down. But the government has increased the floor space index so high that it's much more lucrative for people to break down what is currently on the land and build a skyscraper.
Right.
So, you know, it's got to work with the government. It's got to work with the bureaucracy. It can't just be the people of the city who may want to keep it.
Right.
So that's what's happening in Mumbai today.
Same thing's happening in Singapore. This kind of revision of what we call plot ratio, which is the FAR, allowable FAR, on land, you know, how the master plan goes through these periodic revisions and it typically gets upgraded, then puts a lot of economic pressure on the existing building stock, because why would you keep an old building if you can build something twice as big and make a lot more money? Tell me, is in India, are there skill sets that make conservation scalable?
I think there are plenty of people who know how to conserve. There's a big training force available. Scalable is a difficult question to answer because it depends on what exactly you want to make scalable. If it's ordinary buildings, it's not difficult. If it's heritage buildings, there are enough architects, there's enough technical know-how. And I presume you know about the CSR, which is the corporate social responsibility of all corporates. There's a rule that 2% of their I don't know if it's the turnover or a profit, one of the two, can be given for the CSR. And now heritage is included in that CSR. So we're seeing a great spurt in the number of buildings that are being restored on donations given, if you can call that scalable. But they like to give it to well-known buildings, you know, famous buildings. The ordinary buildings have to be then looked after by the owners or the people who live in it. So it's very complex and complicated in a country like India, You know, we have buildings that are 2,000 years old, and we have new buildings as well. So the span is enormous.
I was in Ahmedabad a couple of weeks ago, and I visited the works of giants like Corbusier and Doshi, who collaborated with institutions and politicians to kind of paint a picture of the future. Let's talk a little bit about how we frame the idea of future today, when big businesses rule and politicians sometimes act like corporate CEOs, right? Starting with the conversations that you hear on the future of India, tell me what is said.
Sustainability is a big question, and it's being discussed. You know, we know very well that we create so much of debris, we use so much of material. There's a huge amount of construction going on, particularly in the infrastructure sector. And that is, of course, cement and steel, as we know. And certainly, how are these created? Of course, we use coal. But we also have to understand that we have 1.4 billion people. And we have to understand that the ordinary person in rural India, by and large, whatever people might say, they consider themselves having a home if it's an RCC roof. And, you know, it's fine to talk about mud and bamboo. It's beautiful. It looks lovely. All of us like to use it. How can you make this scalable when the aspiration of the youth of India, or even older people, where a house is concerned, is to have a pakka house?
Pakka.
And a pakka house means a house where there will be no leakage in the monsoon, and which is an RCC roof. And this is a billion people. So we have to understand some of these basic issues, and, you know, not just glamorize materials which really are used by fashionable architects. And I'm not running down, please don't misunderstand me. These are wonderful things to be done, but how are they scalable? To answer your question, you know, how are you going to build many floors of that in the city? For me, sustainability, Nirmal, goes beyond some of the things we've discussed. It's understanding what people want, to take my point further. For instance, many years ago, I was called by a client, and he said that there was a small temple outside Mumbai, and they wanted to redo the plaza of the temple, and there were flower shops on that plaza. So they built flower shops for these for the flower keepers a little away, and then asked them to move so that they could redo the plaza itself. Mm-hmm. And they all refused to move. So they called me and said, "We don't understand. We have built them something really good. Why are they not moving?" Mm-hmm. I went and met the flower sellers, and I said, "Why are you not moving?" They said, "Nobody asked us what we wanted. They have built these new flower shops far away. People buy their flowers on the way to the temple. They are not going to go out of their way. Secondly, look at the design. We buy flowers. We don't sell them all the same day. We need a place underground which is cool. So we have to raise our shops so we give shade and we can put the flowers underneath overnight." They have built the shops touching the ground. And thirdly, they've not given us any place to hang our flowers and show our customers. So I redesigned, I rebuilt for them, I took them into account, and they all moved without any problem, and we redid the plaza. Now, this to me is, they were unsustainable as the client, because they did not ask them what they wanted.
Right.
It has to begin from the person who is going to be using what you have to build,
yes,
at least in India.
Mm. What does that then say about the role of the designer, the architect? It sounds very much like the architect in this world, in this other place that you are talking about, is a facilitator, a whisperer, if you will, somebody whose job it is not to impose a vision, but rather seek it or to craft it through a bottom-up kind of understanding.
For me, the person for whom I'm building has always been very important. Mm. And I don't believe that that will reduce my creativity or reduce the quality of the building that I design. That's the challenge of the architect. You know, of course we want to build something beautiful. Mm. Of course we want to raise the spirit of the people who come into the spaces that we give them. But that's part of the story. The narrative goes beyond that. And I think that has to be balanced. And that's very important to me.
Let's talk about one of your projects, the Tata Consultancy Services Campus in Indore, which is planned around strong metrics of performance.
This particular project was a 100-acre piece of land where we had to build 1 million square feet. So we got this piece of land which didn't have a tree on it. It had no context or anything. The place where this campus is in Indore in Madhya Pradesh, and quite close to it, there is a very famous river called the Narmada River. I use that as a sort of metaphor for the design of this campus in terms of planning, in terms of the building. So one of the most important things for me was to make sure that when these young people come out of their buildings, they come into the open environment. I was very careful to make sure that I created this central plaza. Mm. We landscaped it in a very careful way. We had water bodies. And I'm happy to tell you that where we created the very shallow water bodies, all the birds have come back. There were no birds when we began the project. Now we have lots of birds who have come back to drink the water there because it's a dry area. And then the way we did not plant roses and tulips and, you know, occidental flowers. We used all the native type of greenery. It looks a little wild in many ways. Then separately, we designed each building very, very carefully. You know, we work with computer modeling. We understand where we are in terms of the sun movement. As you know, positioned as we are, the sun here moves east, southwest. So the southern and western faces are the most, you know, hot. So we control the way we design the fenestrations, what sort of materials we finished for the finishing, how do we maintain in a country like India, which does have a lot of dust and dirt as well. And within the budget, we don't have the Western budgets. We have to work within the budgets that we get. And it's been, you know, what's been so happy and enlightening for us is the videos we get from the young people who are working there. They're sitting in front of their computers because they're all IT engineers. And they say they just love to come out into the spaces. It transports them into another world. And Wonderful. We've done this right in the heart of the campus. So no glass boxes. You know, that's not for India.
Yes.
You know, how do we design?
You've talked about nature as being central to this idea of sustainability and design. You've talked about well-being and biophilic experience as being central to that. You've talked about biodiversity and a biocentric approach to design through hydrology in this case. And of course, the building as a performing entity through passive strategies rather than, you know, engineered solutions. Let me ask you a different question. And this has to do with how corporate architecture like this and other projects, how they strive to achieve the greater good beyond the question of the occupant or the tenant.
I think it really depends on who heads that particular company at that particular time. Mm. I'll be very blunt with you because you have to have corporates where their CEOs are visionaries. Mm. Those are the clients that have given us the freedom to design projects like TCS Indore. Mm. And also a school which I designed in Baroda called the Nalanda School, which again, we had a client who just came to us with his philosophy and his thoughts that he wanted a Gandhian school. He did not want air conditioning all over the place. What do we do to make children respect their environment, to understand why that space is important to them? How do they themselves look after the space? And we did it in many ways. for this client, you know, we created courtyards of different sizes. We created jalis so the air could go through. We used brick in many, many different forms. And we planted a lot of trees around the building to give shade to the building. So the client has to have a visionary head. And companies may not always have that. I have to be lucky to get a project when the head of that corporate or the head of that philanthropic organization is a man or woman with a similar vision to what I have. Mm-hmm. Then when those two, I wouldn't say collide, but when those two meet, that's when a good, important building results in. I mean, today we had a client this morning who came to us because they went to the Nalanda school and they loved it. And they came to us and they said, you know, this is what we want. We want something like this. We don't want a box. So they know, you know, India, you know, Nirmal, how complex India is, how complicated, yes, India is. There's never a single answer to a single question. Never.
I'd like to pause a minute to remind everyone that you can find images and notes to get more out of this episode at ecogradia.com. There you can also learn more about our Season 4 sponsor, the Wholesome Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation is at heart a global community of professionals and academics. Since its beginnings in 2003, the foundation has identified and nurtured leading thinkers and talents in the field of sustainable architecture, design, engineering, and construction across generations and geographies. This community today is immense and impressive, a vast network of practitioners, educators, and specialists who seek out an exchange of ideas and information. And the space where this all happens is created and sustained by the foundation, powered by awards, events, and publications. The ambition of the foundation is nothing less than sustaining life on Earth by finding ways to transform what and how we build for the good of all. Go to wholesomefoundation.org to find out more. Coming back to the way in which sustainability is framed, and I think this is where, you know, individual developments like, say, the Tata Consultancy Services campus or the Nalanda School, these are really good example of virtuous buildings. But I would argue, and I'd be happy for you to counter-argue, that sustainability does not happen at that scale. It happens at the city or the territory scale. And then we begin to trickle down to what buildings have to do to align with that vision. Let's talk with the rural and the bottom up first, the Budley Village in Bhuj. In 2007, this was nominated for an Aga Khan Award and many other accolades. Tell me about this undertaking.
I had this client who's been my client for ages, for whom we built all types of work from industrial factories to houses. When this earthquake happened, it was 2001. It was on January 26th. The same day I got a call from him. And he said, Brinda, there's been a devastating earthquake in Kutch, and we have to go and find a village that we want to rehabilitate. And I said, I'm game. I'm ready to come. So we went, and we had to find a village that nobody wanted. Because, you know, Gujarat, the villages which had a Muslim population, a lot of Muslim NGOs had taken. The villages which had a Hindu population, majority Hindu NGOs had taken. And then we found this wonderful village, which had more or less like a 50-50, and nobody had taken it up. It was very far. It was practically on the border of Pakistan. It was completely destroyed. 90% of the houses, everything had been destroyed. And we went and we saw it. There was debris everywhere. And the government was building, there was an earthquake earlier in Maharashtra called Latur. And what the government had done was on a grid, you know, building house,
cookie
like
cutters.
It was knots and crosses. Yeah. So I knew that that's not what I wanted to do. So I began to talk, talking to the people. And they said, we just have two requirements. One is we want the size of the house, what we had before the earthquake. We have nothing. And secondly, we want to be in the same piece of land next to the same neighbor that we had before. Mm. Because that's what gives us solace. That's what gives us confidence. I said, it's winter. It's January. It's going to take us 9 months to rebuild everything. They said, that's fine. We'll sleep in the open. But that's what we want. So we approached it differently. We then did a lot of mapping. We found out the different houses, the different religious communities, the different castes, who had to be near each other. We can't change social systems overnight. We have to respect certain things and understand. And how do we change their way of thinking? That's another issue. We have to do that our own way. But where they wanted to live, they were very clear. And then the client said that I will give the money to buy the materials, but they have to build it themselves, the houses. Mm. And we will pay them money to build, rebuild. That way, the depression will go away. So it took time, but eventually one man started, then they all began to get together. Then they rebuilt all the houses in the village, and then they decorated them. We reused all the doors, windows, numbered them. We didn't let anything go to waste. We reused all the debris from the broken houses for the road, for the foundation, and for the tanks. We planted trees. And then, of course, we built a lovely school, which was, I'm happy to say, the Fiden book said that's one of the best buildings of the 21st century, a little school. And it's doing so well. So there are many, many stories to Batli. We are not going to have the time today, but I've kept in touch with that village for almost 20 years.
I want to ask you, at the flip end of it, the top down and the urban. Now, you were involved in a project in Mumbai, the Mumbai Esplanade Park. Talk to me about that. What was that about?
So, you know, I've grown up in South Mumbai and I was privileged to have an office also here. But on my way to work, I passed two major railway stations, the Western and the Central. And I would see, you know, around 8:30, 9 o'clock, literally thousands of people falling out of the stations and falling into the road. And then the heavy traffic that you know exists in Mumbai. And it always bothered me. And I didn't know what the answer was, but I would travel to different parts of the world and I would see that outside stations, there would always be a plaza or there would be roads, you know, going below ground to take care of it. It seemed such a reasonable solution. So there was a urban planner called Sidhu, Professor Sidhu, and he and I got together and we prepared this plan of converting 103 acres that existed in the southern part of Mumbai to 153 acres. We were giving 53 acres more of open land in a city like Mumbai by creating plazas around these stations. And so the people, when they came out of the station, they would walk onto a plaza and the cars would go below ground for the short length of tunnels. You know, and we worked so hard on it. We prepared all the drawings. Again, you know, it was a pro bono city project. We worked out the slopes, the angles. We've talked to so many bureaucrats and we thought we were getting somewhere. We had an exhibition. The press supported us. You know, Mumbai may get 51 acres more of land, let's support this. The commuters came to us and said, wouldn't it be lovely that we don't fall under a taxi as soon as we get out? But we did not get any political support or higher senior bureaucratic support to take it further. I worked on it for 2 years. And, you know, finally, I also gave up. It never got completed. So it's frustrating, and that's why I want Nirmal. That's why I want architects. They have to be activists. They can't just stay with their work. They have to really get into politics.
What went wrong there, and what could you have done differently, or was it entirely out of your control?
I think I had to go and work with very senior bureaucrats and politicians. It had to be done at that highest level. Whereas I worked as an architect, as a planner, I talked to the press and the public. But, you know, the people are not enough. It's the decision makers. So you have to go to the decision makers and you have to fight, like we were suggesting, pedestrianization. And I remember at one meeting, one of the senior corporate people said, then how do cars move in that area? So you can see there's so many vested interests that is very, very difficult. And perhaps I should not have done this alone with Professor Sindhu. We were just two of us, although we did so much work. Maybe if we had formed a bigger, I don't know, Nirmal, I really don't know the answer. Mm. I just feel very sad. And I think sometimes I think maybe we were a little ahead of the time. You mm-hmm. know, now they're talking about pavements. Now they're talking about heritage. Now they're talking about some sort of pedestrianization. They're talking about tunnels. They're talking about green spaces being totally inadequate in Mumbai. The in-between spaces. You know, Nandini, my daughter, who works with me, also an architect, she's mm. done a lot of work on in-between spaces. We don't mm-hmm. want gated compounds. We want buildings to be connected with the street.
Mumbai is, and I've been there, it is a pretty challenging city. Has it got better, you know, in the last, say, 10, 20 years as a place to live?
Well, it depends on your economic level. Mm. Certainly, some things are better. Housing, as you know, is a big problem. They're addressing it in different ways. You have the slum rehabilitation now. Builders have come in. So that's another story altogether. It is an amazing city. It's a cosmopolitan city. I think a lot of things have grown. There's a lot of awareness of art, street art, culture, music. There is a lot of freedom. It's a safe city. I don't mind going out late at night. Mm. So, you know, there's a good middle class that's doing very well. The rich, of course, are doing extraordinarily well, as you know. I don't have to tell you. Now, what about the poor? Mm. I think the main problem is housing. Mm. Housing and, of course, water, electricity that goes with it. If we can resolve our housing issues, I think that would be something just wonderful. I have to say transportation will improve. They've built the metro, so the overloaded trains will get some relief. They should concentrate more on public transportation. But they are building a lot of beautiful coastal roads and saying they're building gardens along the road. So, you know, all that goes on as well. Mm. But certainly once the metro starts, things like they have air-conditioned trains now, which they never had earlier. So there is definitely improvement. Mm.
What do you think is a model for urbanism in India today? I mean, is there a conversation on what a good model would be? I mean, I've been to Chandigarh and clearly Chandigarh, you know, the Kabuzian plan had a certain idea of the future. I'd love to hear your thoughts on whether or not that idea made sense or if it materialized, but also what is out there today that's talking about a future urbanism for India, suited for India?
Well, it's got to vary because, you know, there isn't one India. The way people live in Chandigarh, the weather in Chandigarh, and the way people live in Mylapore in Madras is totally different. So there cannot be one solution. You know, Chennai is totally different. The way people live, what they do, how they eat, the family structure, the weather in Chennai, and how do you compare it with, say, Banaras or some city like that? So we have to understand that India is many, many Indias. It's as big as Europe without Russia. You know, it's a huge landmass. And so I think we have to decentralize the way we urbanize our cities. Mm. We have to understand that every city has its own situation that has to be looked at. Now, cities like mega cities like Mumbai, where there's migration, maybe even Bangalore, which have been hit very badly, actually, Bangalore, by this huge migration that's taken place. Chennai is a little different. Hyderabad is also a little different. So each mega city has to have its own way of tackling with the situation. Of course, there are common things. How do you take care of power? How do you take care of water? How do you take care of technology? You know, technology in India, it's truly a digital India. Today, you can go to a market and a small guy selling bananas, you pay him Google Pay, you know. So it's truly digitized. So one, they know, but we have to plan for the future. We have to have plans, say, you know, 2040, 50. I think they're doing that, but the government is not using enough number of architects and planners to help them, according to me. You know, we can't have bureaucrats and politicians doing everything. Have good architects and planners to help you. I'll tell you one typical thing, if you have a minute, is the race course. We have a race course in the heart of the city. Mm-hmm. And the lease of the race course expired. It went into a controversy. So then the government came and said, okay, out of the 200 30 acres in the heart of Mumbai, we will give the race course 110 acres and then we will build something else in the rest of the 120 acres. Maybe some sort of Essel World or, you know, Disneyland or we don't know what. So I wrote an article in the newspaper, which came out in the Times, saying that weather project is so important. With over 230 acres in the heart of the city, why don't you get the best international and national urban planners and architects to work on it? Don't we bring foreign cars in? We have factories which make Mercedes-Benz, BMWs. We have factories which are making even the iPhone. Why are we not open to getting global planners to help us who have been successful in these areas in their own countries? We are not scared. We have competence. We can work with them. But they will come up with some solution of their own.
Mm. Is that also perhaps because design is not fully understood as an expertise?
People have no idea what an architect does here. There is very limited value for the profession and its capabilities. And, you know, maybe that is improving. Mm. When you're sick, you go to a doctor. When you have a legal problem, you go to a lawyer. But when you have an urban design problem, you don't think you need to go to an architect or planner. You think you can do it yourself. Mm, as you exactly. say, they don't understand enough about our contribution or potential contribution.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit about your journey getting here. So you've worked, as you say, more than 200 projects since then. You've also been an advocate for change. I mean, you've been an activist in so many ways. Has the practice of architecture or the regard that is given to architects or planners or designers, any kind of design activity, has that shifted or has it been devalued, in fact?
That's a really tough question. I think because of social media and, you know, the internet, people are more aware of the role of the architect. Mm-hmm. A lot of glamour comes in with a lot of certain type of showrooms, buildings, interiors, magazines, and all that, which people love to look at. But in the serious building aspect, I would say that we still are used by barely, I would say, even under 10% of the population. Now, engineers have always been dominant, you know, right from the British time. And architecture, of course, was a much more recent profession in our country. Mm. And to that extent, laws, I don't know the details, but engineers now are allowed to practice in many ways, and there's always a little bit of that conflict as how are they allowed to do this? How are they? So if you live in a small town, I think you can just go to an engineer and you don't need an architect. You can build your house. So those sort of changes are not there, but I would say within urban areas and because of the growth of the country and the different types of buildings that are coming up, whether they're huge real estate complexes, whether they're museums, hospitals, schools, universities, IT campuses. I mean, there's a huge amount of building that is happening, you know. So to that extent, they need architects. So they have to come to us. Thank goodness for that.
Tell me your birth story.
Well, I was born in Bangalore. I come from the southern part of India, a very beautiful place called Coorg, where they grow coffee. And my mother was a zoologist. My father was a power engineer. And I have one sister. And we all lived in Calcutta and then moved to Mumbai when I was very young. Mm. But when we were very young, my father used to take us to different parts of India. And one of the places he took us to was Nalanda. And that was the ancient Buddhist monastery. I must have been 8 years old. And I just fell in love with it. I have this picture of myself in Nalanda. And I decided then I wanted to be an archaeologist. But I realized later on in time that maybe I couldn't quite become that because I couldn't see myself digging for the rest of my life in some part of hot India. So I became an architect. What could be a better profession in the world? It combines everything, creativity and history and geography, people, you know, sociology, art, music, dance.
That gives a whole other meaning to the quote that we started with, which is the union between the built and the unbuilt. I kind of started thinking about the unbuilt as buildings or cities yet to come. But hearing you talk about your views and your what excites you about the world, there is so much that is unbuilt that you take inspiration from, not just the idea of future cities, but also the cultural nuances and all those shades in between that make India what it is. So thank you for sharing that. I'm in the spirit of connecting history to the future, I'm going to end off by asking you, what gives you hope?
What gives me hope? I don't know if I'm the eternal optimist, but I live each day with excitement. I love to come to work. You know, people often ask me, so Brinda, are you retired now? And I say, gosh, architects never retire. And, you know, it's just the excitement of what's happening every day. And the youth, I think I'm so privileged that I have surrounded by so many young people and hearing them, listening to them. And I love my country. I really do, with all its, you know, all its flaws and all its weaknesses. It has so much strength. It has so much history. And I mean, how can we not have hope with all that we've had for thousands of years? And what's ahead? There's so much richness. And the more we delve into it, the greater we find things about where we are, who we are, where we live. And I just enjoy myself.
Thank you, Brinda. I really enjoyed talking to you. Really appreciate you making the time today.
Thank you, Nirmal, so much for this opportunity.
I'd also like to thank you all for tuning in. There is much more about this episode waiting to be unpacked at ecogradia.com, where you can also find all past episodes, their images and notes on dedicated pages from season one up to now. If you enjoyed today's conversation and have yet to do so, please click on the follow button on your preferred podcast directory. You can also vote now for Ecogradia, nominated this year for the Webby Awards in the Sustainability and Environment Podcast category. Simply go to our website to find the link that leads you directly to the voting page. These small clicks, they can make a huge difference and help this channel grow bigger, stronger, better. Do follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn and subscribe to our newsletter to know first what's coming up next. Helping us on this journey is our sponsor for Season 4, the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. And the foundation is a leading organization whose sole mission is to promote a new way of thinking and acting in the design construction sector globally. Their goal is to give you the resources you need to make your own journey towards sustainability a little easier. Go to wholesomefoundation.org to find out more. Finally, I want to thank the small team that put this episode and related content together. Maxim Flores, Kruti Kothari, Sana Gupta, Tyler Yeo, and from Phlogiston, Alexander Melk, Kelvin Brown, Sheldon Kum, Gaylord Magurka, Madeline Meiber, and Stian van Beek. Thanks, everyone. Until we meet next, this is Nirmal Kishnani, signing off in Singapore.